Sometimes we speak in discussing Buddhism of the burning world. And in the Tibetan mandala tradition, a mandala is often represented with a circle, and the outer rim of the circle is flames. They may be in particular colors, according to symbolic things in the Tibetan tradition, but it's burning. And within that, there is often something that indicates the way in which duality comes about. It's speaking of the essence of a human being, the divided nature of us human beings. And this burning world is a world that is burning with suffering. Central observation of the Buddha. The inevitability of suffering. As long as people are dualistic, as long as there is a battle going on between one thing and another within their minds, the idea that one should be this way, should be that way, and one is not, and therefore, and so on. And the worries about how the future will turn out, and the worries about whether they did the right thing in the past, and on it goes. This is what is meant by the burning world. In addition to many more, let's say, painful varieties of suffering, the way in which human beings inflict suffering upon other people, out of their motivations towards power and lust and greed and whatever else. This is the world that the Buddha observed. This is the world that will always be here, because it is inherent in human beings. As long as human beings have this dualistic nature, this nature where the world is divided up into right and wrong, good and bad, you and me, and on it goes, yesterday and tomorrow, and the right way and the wrong way. It's inevitable. So this matter of Buddhism and the process of the liberation from suffering is not something that has to do with the time of the Buddha, nor does it have to do with anything Asian. It has to do with our structure as human beings. And this is an important thing to observe about us beings. Many people, having a narrow idea of suffering, feel that they are not suffering. They read about suffering, the agonies that people in Darfur and so on are going through, and it is, of course, very tragic and very poignant for us human beings to see that other members of our human species are experiencing such things, not to mind other sentient beings, the animals, the birds, and so on. Or even trees, to see them wantonly cut down in order to clear the space for something else. But this is what we do. And it results in great aggression and great judgment into those things that are important and those things that are unimportant. And the unimportant things can be dealt with as objects. You do not have to empathize with them. We do that with our fellow beings. And we do that with ourselves. I'm so stupid. I hate myself. People say that all the time. Without inquiring a little bit further, just a little bit further. Bring forth the one that hates, and bring forth the other one too while you're at it. The one that is hated, bring it forth. But people don't go deeply into their being. They suffer on the surface, without going underneath. One of the principles of our practice is not to be so concerned with the leaves on the tree, but to be concerned with the roots. We are concerned with what is the source of suffering, and what is the source of happiness and liberation. That is what we are concerned about. And because of the great preoccupation that people have with the surface, everybody knows this. This is not just what the media feeds us. Things that are seemingly so important today, and last month, what was that thing that was so important? And last year, and oh, those things that were so important to people in the 80s, and so on and so on. How it goes, this transiency, it comes and goes, it flashes into, covering the whole internal screen of consciousness, and so on, willy-nilly. Zen realizes that in order to come to the source, one has to liberate oneself, first of all, from the bondage to these things that occupy one's whole field of consciousness, thus excluding the possibility of clearing the field of consciousness so that that which is underneath, and most underneath, is our, what we call in Buddhism, our true nature. How to clear the way so that that can become perceivable. Which it cannot as long as the mind is filled with all these sorts of things. So therefore, the first and primary practice of, I won't say Buddhism because there are so many sects of Buddhism, many of which pray to Amitabha Buddha, often the Pure Land, and want things, and they chant Nam-myoho Renge-kyo in order to get something for themselves, a new BMW or whatever it may be, and so on. And they call themselves Buddhists. But the central core of this teaching that leads to liberation, which was the sole function of the Buddha and of all the Zen masters since that time, has been to identify the source of this suffering and the source of liberation, and to help individuals using the experience that they have all accumulated over those lifetimes to aid their fellow being in order that this may occur, and to continue in their own life to refine it so that they themselves are able to do this congruently. To the central practice, the beginning practice, and the practice that goes on ceaselessly, is to observe the mind. Not to be taken by the mind, which is the case for most people. Thoughts come in and they pull people around. One has to learn to step back and observe that process. Observe how that thought came in and started to build and then transformed into something else and so on. Don't get interested in what it got transformed into or where it came from or what the details and colors and pictures are of it, but just notice the process. Things arise, they take form, they come in, they vanish, they get transformed into other things, they, through association, through whatever. And notice the ghosts that people deal with. Don't notice that in oneself, this is essential. The ghosts of self, the ghosts of past, what things should have been so, and all the rest of it. See into the nonsense of it. Now, we don't have the occasion at this point to go into how one does that. When I say the nonsense of it, it begs a little explanation, but this is not a talk about all and everything. As I'm moving towards a certain thing to discuss, but I want to point out that the avenue for appropriately utilizing this great tradition is to learn and to cultivate this attitude of observing the mind, being a witness, as though it's somebody else's consciousness. You know, saying, oh yeah, there's that thought that comes. Oh yeah, there's that feeling that comes about it too, back to breath or back to mood, depending on what you're working on. But always returning to this breath, but not being concerned, and learning the attitude of this benevolent, dispassionate attitude towards all these thoughts. Let them come in if they want, let them go out if they want. You don't care. It doesn't matter to you. They're not any of your business. That's a big shift. People think it's all their business just because it came into their mind, like junk mail coming into their mailbox. It must be for me because it's got my name on it. It's all silliness. Same thing about our thoughts. We say this over and over. I'm just mentioning it again here because this is such an essential practice. And it's important for what I want to talk about tonight. As is patience. Patience. Patience fundamentally is the absence of aggression. We human beings, especially in our time, from what I understand about earlier times, people had more patience. They weren't in such a hurry to do this and that, to accomplish this and that. They would give it an appropriate time. They didn't expect results tomorrow in such matters as we're discussing. But we have become addicted with speed. And so therefore we get to be addicted to appearance rather than essential, fundamental transformation. So it's learning a lot of things, how not to care about a lot of things, to be able to disregard them as though they're really just coming about by causes and conditions, but they're none of your business. And learning how to come back, to come back. Gradually the mind gets purified, it gets cleared of all this noisy stuff. And then one is ready for this next phase, where one starts to appreciate certain things. Now, for example, and this is related to what I want to talk about tonight, for example, you look at this carpet. Initial responses of most people to the carpet is brown. And then variegated, you look carefully and see patterns. And then you wonder about the, is this universal? Does it go through the whole carpet? And on it goes. This is the mind. It's none of your business. Why do you bother with it? You don't have to make this carpet. It's just the way it is. You look at grass. You might, if you have some scientific bent, think about photosynthesis or think about the amount of oxygen that's being produced by this field of grass and how it's benefiting the world and using up carbon dioxide and all the rest of it. But that's not moving in the direction of finding what the source is of us human beings. That is being caught, as we say, in content, which is a very valuable thing to do by choice, but not with automaticity. So therefore the practice that we have is we observe these things and we notice, yes, minds do that, and we come back to breath, if it's breath that you're working on, but you come back. And that coming back starts to liberate you from the chains of bondage to this addiction to content. Now, if you look at a leaf, for example, you might say, what kind of leaf is that? It's not I think it's a maple leaf. Yes, that's right, it's a maple leaf. It's got those characteristics that are in the class, if I remember my botany rightly, of acer. And so it's got these things, little points on the leaves and all that sort of stuff. And some varieties will produce maple syrup, and on it goes. The mind goes off and runs off in its own directions. And if you know some botany, it'll go off even worse. I'll think of stomata and gutation and all kinds of things. So you've got to let those things come and go. They're fine, they're very useful in some contexts, but not for this context. To this leaf. If you just look at the leaf and let go of all associations, all names, all associations of every kind, the leaf starts to become different. In the sense that it becomes a unique object. It becomes a unique entity. There's a certain fascination grows about it when you let go of the idea of, well, it's just a leaf. In other words, unimportant. You go, oh, yeah, unimportant, and making things important and unimportant is one of the things his minds do. Oh, yeah, let that go. You come back then to the leaf. or whatever it is. It could be your watch. Now, that's very important for what I want to talk about tonight. This is a koan in the Heikkigen Roku, which is one of the collections of koan that we use in our Zen training. And it's number 5. And it goes like this. Seppo was referred to here, and Seppo was a great master during the Tang Dynasty. And for the consolation and reassurance of everyone here, he took a long time to come to awakening. But he's persistent. And he eventually came to a very profound enlightenment and was one of the great Zen masters of the Tang Dynasty. We might even say he was a Buddha in the Tang Dynasty. What, after all, is a Buddha? Again, we get to what we're talking about in Zen. We are not so concerned with Shakyamuni Buddha. We honor him, and we're glad that he founded this whole process and lineage. But what we're concerned is what the essence of that Shakyamuni was that manifested in him and gave those teachings and came to enlightenment. What is that essence? And that essence is what he wanted everyone to know is their nature. And Zen is concerned with aiding people in order to, that they may realize the same thing in their own being, this Buddha nature. And so Seppo, the great master, was concerned with this and with his students. And eventually he had an enormous number of students. It's really astounding to realize the nature of things in the Golden Age of Zen, as it's often been called in China, the Tang Dynasty from roughly 600 to 900 AD. Seppo himself had 1,500 students. 1,500 students. It's pretty remarkable. Anyhow, this is a story about Seppo. It's one of our koan. It's one of the way, it's one of the records that we use in our training in order to refine, enter more deeply into what this fundamental nature is. So, Seppo addressed the assembly of his students and said, "All the great world, if I pick it up with my fingertips, is found to be like a grain of rice. I throw it in front of your face, but you don't see it. Go, beat the drum. Tell the monks to come out to work and search for it." So we never, as we discussed koan, go into the response that a person would be working on to make to this story if they were undergoing the traditional Zen training that we offer. But we can glean a great deal from these stories without doing that. So Seppo, all of these koan, in a manner of speaking, as we say, they throw sand in your eyes in order that you may see more clearly. So how does he throw sand in the eyes here? He invites the people to think of the great world, this great world. And they might be thinking of the great world of enlightenment. They may be thinking of the great world of Buddha nature. They may be thinking of just the great physical world with all the wonderful mountains and plains and rivers and so on in the China that they were familiar with. This great world. Maybe including stars and planets and whatever. And he says, if I pick it up on my fingertips, it's like a grain of rice. I throw it in your face and you don't see it. Come, beat the drum, kill them all to come out and search for it. What's he doing? He's creating a paradox in their minds. The great world and a grain of rice? Why? A grain of rice is one of the most common things. We eat hundreds of them every day. These little things, they're all just irrelevant. So what's really important is the Buddha nature. This is what people are trapped in. Among many things. And so he presents this paradox. Are they going to find it? Hopefully they will. But how will you find it? Now I mentioned the leaf and the carpet. The essential beginning is to drop off all the names and ideas that you have about anything. I'm not saying they're not useful. Yes, they are useful in many contexts, and you should realize that. This is not becoming an imbecile in society. But put them in their place. They are useful in certain contexts, but not in the context of searching for this fundamental reality. Realize that all the names are merely made up by the human mind. Great world, what is that? Well, it differs with everybody who says great world. It's their own private code for something or other. There's a file in their mind that has that name on the tab. Great world, everything about the great world is in this file. Great world, not the mundane world, not the silly world, not the family world, not that this world or that world, but the great world. And then there's things like a grain of rice. They may not even have a file. Just these little things. It's like grains of sand. William Blake said the whole world is to be seen in a grain of sand. So here's this rice grain. Now the rice grain is analogous to the leaf I was speaking of before, or the carpet. If you drop away all names, all associations, all the ideas that you have in your mind about this thing, it becomes a thing in itself. You don't know it at all. It becomes more and more engaging, fascinating, if you let yourself be engaged by it. And that's the thing. Because what stops you from doing that is the commonplace mind that will say, well, I'm engaged with it. I'm here for enlightenment, do you understand? Not to understand a rice grain. See, this is just the mind producing thoughts. This is just the mind showing that it renders this idea important and this idea unimportant. Not recognizing that all it's doing is just manifesting its classification system inside the mind. It has nothing to do with this object, this leaf, this carpet, this grain of rice. Nothing whatsoever. Nor is the essence of this grain of rice to be explored by thinking about its structure and how it is derived from the rice plant and how the rice plant grows up from seeds and these patties and is it harvested in certain ways and so on. All of that may be very interesting, but as you look at that rice grain, what we're talking about is just the essence of this thing. And the essence of that thing is the same as the essence of the leaf and the carpet. There's a certain isness about it, we can't put a word on it. The reality of this thing, the marvel of this thing. We have a couple of cats, and the cats, if there's new stuff comes in, they go to them, they look at it. They sniff it, and they look around at it. It's like, what is this? Fortunately, they maybe have a shorter attention span. And they don't have the classification system that we sophisticated beings have. Oh, that is just a rice grain. I don't eat rice. It's uninteresting to me. Stuff like that. Yeah, what? What? What's that? What? What? What's that? Many animals do the same thing. You have dogs or cats, you know that they do that. Until they get too old, and then they're kind of, they've seen it all, you know, they bother. But this is the thing. So one has to use that simply as an analogy. I'm not saying that you try to mimic it, but I'm saying use it as an analogy. We have laid names and ideas over everything that we have encountered. And those layers of things that we put on them may be useful in some contexts. But in this particular context, they are obstacles. So we have to learn a new art and science of dealing with this mind without letting it be caught with the things that in some contexts are useful, but they do not represent reality. They represent our structure of that we call reality. Our own internally created thing, our classification, our model of the world, that's what they are. They are not it itself. So we need to clear all the traces of our model of the world. All the things we have judged as being important or unimportant, or all the associations we have through time and through the scientific study of these things and everything, just let them all go. We're looking at the existence of this thing. This leaf, this carpet, this grain of rice. Now we can empathize with the, what do we say, the exasperation, real or pretended here towards his monks, of I throw this stuff in front of you every day and you don't see it. I tell you every day about what reality is, and how to realize this reality, and what do you do with it? You put it back in your classification system and represent it as an idea. Sometimes a Zen master calls a monk like that a rice bag. All you're doing here is just coming here to eat and, you know, hang out. So he's inviting them to wake up, beat the drum, come out here, search for it. That's what needs to happen for every individual doing this authentic practice. It's searching for it. Searching for what? Now, it's not searching for something, because to search for something, you have to know what you're looking for. Where did I put my keys? You have to know what the bunch of keys looks like in order that you can search for it. So search isn't quite the right word here. But that's another way in which you throw sand in their eyes. Because they don't have any idea, many of them, what the awakened mind is all about. And so if they search for it, if they search of the great world as represented in this rice grain, then they're... But if they persist, what happens? If they persist, old William Blake once again said, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. And he says, a fool that persists in his folly becomes wise. So if you persist, where is the great world in this rice grain? The great world, where is it? Where is it? You come to this place where there's a brick wall. You can't answer the question. And so you are required to stay with it and produce a response that will be evaluated as being right on or not by your teacher. So you continue. You continue, and you may then leap into another way of perceiving the world. Another way of approaching this question, what is it? The same thing with, who are we? We have all these ideas. We identify with an ethnic group, with our accomplishments, with our emotional nature, with our consciousness, with our... whatever it is. That's all just a story. It doesn't breathe you. It doesn't walk you. It's not here right now doing your life at this very moment. It's not here. It's a story. It consoles you. It's something that people talk about. How are you? How did you do yesterday? How did that work out? And so on and so on. You're invited to produce the tale of what you call your life. But it's not your life. Your life is right here, breathing, sitting, it's not even that. What is it? What is this rice grain that is the great world? This is the kind of inquiry that is undertaken as one pursues one's path in Zen. So there's a verse that was written by the compiler of this set of koans, actually by another person, by Secho. And he says, the ox head, there's a little verse to each of these koans, and this is the verse for this one. The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. No dust on the mirror of the patriarch Soke. You beat the drum and search for it in vain. For whom do the spring flowers bloom? So that ox head disappearing, the horse head appearing, is like thoughts coming into the mind. First there's this thought, but then it transforms and it's replaced by another thought, and the ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. No dust on the mirror of Patriarch Soke. It used to be, according to some practitioners of Zen in the early days, in the days of the sixth, in the days of Wei Nong, that's who's referred to as Soke. There was a little contest about the transmission of this Dharma, and we don't need to go into the details. It was very famous and very wonderful, but one of the images that came out of it was that one of the people said that our mind is like a mirror, and that we have to keep dusting it, cleaning it off, so that the world can be represented clearly. Like a mirror. A mirror looks everywhere and makes no judgment. It just reflects what it sees. And it's very important for us to learn how to look at the world, hear the world, be in the world, without judging. So there is one of the four great wisdoms in Buddhism is called the great mirror wisdom. And that's what it means. That we look at the world, we appreciate the world, similarly to the way a mirror does, no judgment. Open to anything, seeing everything, but not judging, not evaluating, not categorizing, not making one thing better than the other. They're all there. Wei Nong, on the other hand, said, there isn't even a mirror, not to mine dust on it. And so that's what's referred to here. There's no dust on the mirror of Soke. Because when you come down to it further, the dust on the mirror, while it might be a useful image to work with, is ultimately, likewise, has to be dropped. Because anything that you can name, any process, is not it. But you come to this beautiful place of not knowing. And so the last line of the verse, and therefore the second last line says, you beat the drum and search for it in vain. Because as long as you search for something, you're acting as though you know what it is you're searching for. And you have to become humbler than that. You have to let go of that idea, because it's only an idea. An idea made up from the information that you already have, that you've thought about, read about. But it is not the thing itself. It is not this fundamental nature. It is not enlightenment. It can't be. If you have not experienced it, it can't be. So how can you search for it? Of course, not to mind it, it ignores the fact that the Buddha said, you are it. So what is this searching business if you are it? There has to be a different process. A process, as we've referred to earlier, with letting that which is in the way of your perceiving it, like removing the veil, letting the veil drop away, letting the things with which you have been preoccupied drop away as being that which fills your mind. That is the way in which the perception of this fundamental nature can happen. So he says at the last line of this wonderful little verse, for whom do the spring flowers blossom? For whom? Why these spring flowers? Like the leaf, like the carpet, like the grain of rice. There just is. There just is. They're not blooming for you or me or anybody else. No identified being are they in relationship with. They are a manifestation of it itself. They just is there. They just am there. The way you fundamentally are. If you weren't preoccupied with your ideas about yourself and about what you want to search for and gain and get rid of and the things you don't like and the things you like and the things you want to have in the future and all those kinds of things that are cluttering the mind. If you let them all go, then you become like these flowers. For whom do they bloom? Why, they bloom for you. They bloom as bodhisattvas, showing you right in front of your eyes. Like Seppo says, I throw this rice grain in front of you and you don't see it. Here are these flowers. And maybe we shouldn't use the idea of flowers because people think the flowers are so beautiful. It's really, Buddhism must be about beautiful things. Buddhism is about everything. If it's not about everything, it's not Buddhism. Everything has this quality. But if your attention is drawn to a flower as it is, because you still might be in the position of thinking that all these blades of grass are just more blades of grass. But if you see a beautiful flower, then you pause, you look. That's the essential thing. You pause, you look, you look. You look at maybe. Maybe if you look, you'll see. Look at this thing, manifesting itself before you, caring not for how it arrived, caring not for its duration of life, just being. Just being. Everything in this world, rice grain, blades of grass, oak trees, flowers, they're all manifesting this fact. They are all bodhisattvas teaching us. Look, this is being. We are doing it, apart from all your ideas about this is beautiful and that's not beautiful. This tree is well formed and that one's not so well formed. You should trim it on that side so it'll be symmetrical. That's human ideas. All these things are manifesting themselves just as they are. Open the eyes. Open the eyes. This is to see the whole world in this grain of rice. This is what Seppo was talking about. It is the task offered to everyone undertaking this great practice of Zen. We'll end there today.